promotion and prestige either flowed or was withheld. At this moment of triumph, Dr. Wexler was all smiles and accolades. "You've done it, Edouard," she enthused over the bubbling chatter of the elated scientists and engineers. "A successful landing. It's going to be a happy Christmas for us all." Urbain heard champagne corks popping, the laughter and the raucous horseplay that comes when nerve-twisting tension is suddenly released. Although he felt the same joy and satisfaction, he had no desire to celebrate, no urge to behave foolishly. All he really wanted at this particular moment was to get to the urinal. Wexler was not about to release him, though. She grasped his forearm with fleshless, talon-like fingers, hard enough to make Urbain wince, and began to introduce him to the other important persons who had flown all the way out to Saturn for this momentous occasion. She was hardly an imposing figure. Dr. Wexler looked hard, brittle, Urbain thought. A short, bony woman with an intense bird-like face and plain brown hair cut short, wearing a tailored tunic and deep blue slacks, designed more to disguise her skeletal figure than to make a fashion statement. Yet she had power and the ruthlessness to wield it. Back on Earth, she was often called Attila the Honey. Not to her face, of course. Urbain himself was quite elegant. He had given a lot of thought to his wardrobe for this morning's event, and, with his wife's help and eventual approval, had selected a trim gray business suit with a soft Persian blue silk cravat. Jean-Marie was in the crowd of onlookers, he knew. Searching for her, he finally saw her watching him, her eyes glowing with his success. "She is beautiful," Urbain thought. "Beautiful and happy, at last." 37 university and news media VIPs had flown on a high-velocity fusion torch ship to this habitat in orbit around Saturn, courtesy of Pancho Lane and Astro Corporation. Normally, the men and women who directed the International Consortium of Universities preferred to remain on Earth and spend their money on research or teaching. Normally, news network executives sent their reporters afield while they remained in their opulent offices. But Pancho Lane was heading for Habitat Goddard and had invited the ICU and the news media to send a contingent along with her. So here they were. Urbain suffered through what seemed like an endless round of introductions. Wexler even introduced him to Professor Wilmot, who had been aboard Goddard from the outset as its chief administrator, living and working with Urbain for nearly 3 years now. "Good show today, Edward," said Wilmot jovially as they clasped hands while Wexler beamed approvingly. "Hope everything goes this well tomorrow." Tomorrow, Urbain thought. Christmas Day, when they begin to turn on Titan Alpha's sensors and start the exploration of Titan's surface. "Have some champagne, Edouard," Wilmot proffered his own untouched plastic cup. "You've earned it."
Not just yet, thank you," Urbain replied. "There is something I must do first."
23 December, 2095, the day before. The successful landing of Titan Alpha on the cloud-shrouded surface of Saturn's largest moon was not the only startling event aboard Habitat Goddard. A day earlier, Pancho Lane had provided fireworks of a different sort. Although she had officially retired as CEO of Astro Corporation, Pancho still had enough clout to commandeer the fusion torch ship Star Power 3 for a 6-week flight to distant Saturn, and to bring a gaggle of ICU bigwigs and news executives with her, as well as her personal bodyguard and lover. Pancho made her way up Star Power 3's paneled central passageway towards the bridge to watch the torch ship's approach to Goddard through the bridge's glass steel ports. Once an astronaut herself, she had no patience with sitting in her compartment and staring at a video display of the approach and docking, nor was she in a mood to mingle with the passengers in the central lounge, flatlanders most of them. Earthworms who had never been farther than the comfortable cities on the moon and only traveled deeper into space in the luxury and safety of this commodious torch ship. If the ship's captain or crew members felt uncomfortable with the retired head of the corporation poking around their bridge, they did their best to hide it. Pancho sat in the vacated life support console, where she could gaze through the bridge's sweeping windows of heavily tinted glass steel as Star Power 3 neared Goddard's main docking port. It took an effort to keep her eyes off Saturn. The planet bulked huge and looming, nearly 10 times bigger than Earth, striped with soft tan and muted yellow clouds, whipping along at hyper-hurricane velocities. White clouds circled the pole. Or was that an aurora? Poncho wondered. It's summertime down there in the southern hemisphere, she thought. Temperature's probably getting close to 150 below zero. They must be clouds, ice formations. The rings were tipped so that Poncho could see them in all their dazzling complexity, glittering, glistening broad bands of gleaming ice chunks hanging in emptiness. Stupendous rings, many thousands of kilometers across, yet so thin that the stars shone through them. This close, Poncho could see that the rings were braided, countless individual rings woven together like a rich circular tapestry made of brilliant diamonds. Some of the scientists claim that there were living creatures in those ice particles, extremophiles that thrived at temperatures near absolute zero. Compared to gaudy Saturn and those radiant rings, the man-made Goddard was not much to look at, Poncho thought, as she watched the massive habitat growing larger. It was a thick, ungainly cylinder, 20 kilometers long and 4 across, rotating slowly to produce an artificial gravity for the 10,000 men and women living inside it. It reminded Poncho of a stubby length of storm drain pipe hanging in the emptiness, although as they neared it, she could see that its surface was pebbled with observation bubbles, docking ports, antennas, and other projections studying the cylinder's curving flank. And at about 2/3 of the way along the cylinder stood the ring of solar mirrors standing like a collar of flower petals, drinking in sunlight for the habitat's farms and electrical power and life support. Susie's in there, Poncho thought. And then she remembered, mustn't call her Susie anymore. She changed her name to Holly, and it damn near killed her. Despite her best intentions, Poncho couldn't help feeling a simmer of resentment about her sister. Suze was only 3 years younger than Poncho, as far as calendar age was concerned. But while Poncho had allowed her hair to go stark white and was taking rejuvenation therapies to stave off the encroachment of age, Susan was physically no more than 30, and mentally, emotionally, Poncho grimaced at the thought. Susan had died while she was a teenager. Poncho had administered the lethal injection herself, once the medical experts had woefully assured her that there was no hope of saving Susan from the drug-induced cancer that was ruining her body. So Poncho pushed the hypodermic syringe into her sister's emaciated arm and watched her die. As soon as she was pronounced clinically dead, the medic slid her body into a heavy stainless steel sarcophagus, a coffin-sized door that they filled with liquid nitrogen, steaming white, deadly cold. For more than 20 years, Poncho guarded Susie's cryonically preserved body as she herself climbed the corporate ladder of power from hell-raising astronaut to CEO and board chairman of Astro Corporation. Poncho directed Astro's side of the second asteroid war, and once that tragedy ground to its exhausted, blood-soaked finish, she had formally retired from Astro to start a new life of... what? She asked herself. What am I doing here? All the way the hell out at Saturn. What am I going to do with the rest of my life? Her immediate plans, she knew. She was going to see her sister for the first time in nearly 3 years, spend the holidays with the only family she had. The thought made her tense with apprehension. Once Susan had been revived from her long years of cryonic suspension and her cancer removed by therapeutic nanomachines, she was like a newborn baby in a young adult's body. The years she had spent bathed in liquid nitrogen had saved her body, but destroyed most of the synapses in the cerebral cortex of her brain. She had practically no higher brain functions. Poncho had to feed her, teach her to speak again, and to walk, even toilet train her. Slowly, Susan became a mature adult. Yet even when the psychologist happily proclaimed her training to be a complete success, Poncho was disturbed. She wasn't the same Susie. Couldn't be, Poncho realized. Yet the difference unsettled her. She looked like Susie, talked and laughed and flirted like Suze, but she was subtly different. When Poncho looked into her sister's eyes, it was somebody else in there, almost the same, but only almost. And the first thing Suze